We got to start with the power play, which is now 1-4 its last 40 something. It's mind blowing. I think I saw it's 11th in the league now, and it was first for quite a bit of time this season. What the hell has happened? What's going on? How do we define, address the issues here, and how do they get it going again?
Yeah, whenever something crazy like this happens, the first thing I like to do is quickly check the shooting percentage. And in the last month, they're dead last in the NHL in shooting percentage. So there's a bit of poor luck there. But more concerningly, if you just look at shot rate, they're 20th in the NHL over the last month. So that indicates that they're not getting into the offensive zone enough. They're not gaining the zone. And that's the most important part of a power play. If you look at some of the research, my favorite stuff was done by Eric Parnas before he got snagged up by Colorado. Now he's working for their analytics department. But he had some great research that showed the most effective way to measure power play performance and to predict future goals in the power play. It's the teams who gain the zone with high efficiency and are able to set up in formation. And if you look at the Leafs lately, they've struggled to get over the blue line and really set up. Is that a talent deficiency? Is it maybe because they've had a Joe Thornton and Wayne Simmonds there in the past? I don't know, because if you look at their last few games, they've been trying to top load it. William Nylander obviously hasn't been there for the last week. They've had Zach Hyman as the net front, but Mitch Marner has been struggling to gain the zone. Auston Matthews, when he was in the lineup, isn't gaining the zone at the rate that you'd like to see on the power play. And then even when they're in the offensive zone, the puck movement seems predictable to me. There's not enough motion. It seems if I'm a penalty killer on the opposing team trying to shut down the Leafs power play, I just clog up the neutral zone. And once they gain the zone, I kind of know what they want to do. I know that they want to go east-west to Matthews. If I load up on Matthews and take away that shot, are they going to threaten me in any other kind of major way? They haven't been doing that right now. And if you look at some of the best offenses in sports, you have your go-to play, and everyone knows what the Leafs want to do. They want Auston Matthews to get that strong side wrist shot, bar down. It's what he's been doing his whole career. But when that play isn't there, do you have a backup option? Do you have a third option that you can go to on the power play that's going to have success? They haven't been doing it lately, but I do think they have the pieces to do it. If you get a Marner and a Nylander kind of down on the line, work the goal line a little bit, thread some passes from behind the net, I think there are some things they can do to improve this power play. But I hear you, man. It's been frustrating. A team with this much skill shouldn't be struggling to gain the zone on the power play.
Mm-hmm. So, Ian, then where do you – and this is probably a more abstract question, but where do you draw the line between it's up to the players on the ice – and then it's also up to the coaching staff to help them prepare as much as possible. I think Manny Malhotra is the power play coach. So, like, how much is it on Keefe or Malhotra, and how much is it on the players? Like, how do you do that split in your mind?
Yeah, and you are right. It is Manny Malhotra. Last year it was Paul McFarland. Before that, they had Jim Hiller. This is kind of like when we see an offensive coordinator come in for a quarterback, and it's changing every year, and there's a new plan every year. With the power play, you would think that you just put your five best players on the ice and eventually the skilled players will make skilled plays in tight spaces and beat the defense and they'll eventually score a goal. But I think there is a lot more tactically that goes into a power play than a lot of fans realize. I think the best iteration of the Leafs power play over the last decade was the Marner, Kadri, JVR unit that they had back in the day, where Marner would start on the right wall and he'd go for the slap pass to the middle. If that wasn't there, he'd work it down low to JVR. And then they'd converge for the rebound. Four forwards would attack, outnumber them down low. They haven't been doing that as much. They haven't been going for that slap pass to the bumper because for a lot of this season, the bumper has been Joe Thornton, and he's not exactly a shot threat in the middle of the ice. I do wonder that if they put Tavares in the bumper role, they have Marner on the right wall, Matthews on the left wall, Riley at the point. You're left with one more player to have there. And I think the player that you choose to run as your net front is going to dictate the tactics that you're going to employ. Because if you're going to have a Wayne Simmonds there or a Zach Hyman there, that's a true net front presence. That's kind of a big body in front you're going to have there for screens. But if you have a William Nylander there or a Mitch Marner, we've seen them use as a quote-unquote net front presence before. He likes to back off away from the crease, kind of towards the bottom of the goal line, and work some more east-west passing lanes from there. So as much as I would just say, hey, put more talent on the ice and let them figure it out, I do think there's a tactical approach to breaking down defenses where you have a number one option, a number two option, a number three option. As of right now, I'd say that the Leafs have their number one option, but they don't have a plan B or a plan C to really take advantage of opposing penalty kills when they overload on Matthews, when they commit to taking away that one thing you want. I think the Leafs tactically need to prepare for that and make sure that they have some other options. And lately, they haven't really been doing that.
Ian Tulloch is with us. So, you know, it seems obvious to say, but considering you know, how much of a premium special teams opportunities are in the playoffs. You know, you usually need to make your hay at 5-on-5. But when you get opportunities on the power play, on special teams, you'd like to think that you have a unit that's capable of taking advantage of those opportunities from time to time. How much, you know, of an important factor is it to get the power play back into at least competency come the playoffs, knowing that you're probably going to need it if you want to get to where you want to go?
I think it's huge, especially for the way that this roster is constructed. They're so top-heavy in their elite talent. And when you have elite talent like that, you expect them to produce on the power play. When I think of teams that you would compare them to in years past, you think of Pittsburgh with Crosby, Malkin, Kessel. You think of Tampa Bay with Stamkos, Kucherov, Braden Point. If you have that much talent on the ice, you should be able to work seam passes and work quick little passes to the bumper and basically overload defenses with your options. I think if we think of the best Leafs power plays, even with the current players they've had over the last 2 years, let's say with John Tavares, Mitch Marner, Auston Matthews, and William Nylander, it's when the puck is zipping around and the defense can't do anything in time. And then you make that seam pass east-west, the defense is scrambling, it's back up to Matthews, he slides it over to Tavares, and it's in the back of the net before the defense realizes what happened. So I agree with you. I think this is something they really need to get fixed, because if you're going to win a championship with this roster, you need a top five power play. That's just the way their cap sheet is allocated. But in order to accomplish that, how do you go about it? I think that's the more interesting question. And it's up to Manny Malhotra these last 15 games of the season. He's got to figure it out, because if he doesn't, I think his job could be on the line here.
So I want to ask you, Ian, a little bit about a couple of individual players. And I saw in your report cards that for last night, even with the loss, that John Tavares was your five-star player, right? And that I think one of the things that you said, which really encapsulates the point, was that he has been looking like John Tavares again lately, which is just so good to see, right? I mean, he really took a beating in the court of public opinion, it felt like, when to start the season, and really through much of the season, I guess. But you're right, I think it does really seem like he has gotten back to being the Tavares that we all know and love from years past. And I just, what has been behind that in your eyes?
Yeah, because whenever I'm trying to make evaluations on these guys, I try to combine both what I'm seeing with my eyes, but also look at the numbers as well, because sometimes my eyes will lie to me, and then I'll go look at the stat sheet and realize that one player who I thought was playing well, they're actually getting caved in for the majority of their shifts. So maybe you need to reevaluate how you're looking at things, Ian. So with John Tavares to start the year, if I'm just assessing him to start the season, the first month of the year, he wasn't making high skill plays. He wasn't breaking down his defender one-on-one. He wasn't dynamic in transition. I was really worried about offensively what he was able to do with the puck on his stick. If you look at his last few games, even the last couple of weeks, in the offensive zone, he looks like the John Tavares that we saw with the New York Islanders. That famous Sean Couturier clip where he's playing perfect defense along the boards, just pinning him, and John Tavares is escaping it with quick cuts. He can stick handle in a phone booth. And I think my favorite thing about John Tavares in terms of what he provides offensively is just the way he works out of tight spaces in the offensive zone. In open space, he's actually not that dangerous. You'd much rather have a William Nylander or a Mitch Marner in open space. But in tight spaces, in the offensive zone, off the cycle, where he's got a man draped all over his shoulder, he can find a way to get around that man. And now he's forcing two forwards or two defenders to commit to him off the cycle. And if you have two players committing to you, that means that one of your teammates will be wide open. That's what happened on the Zach Hyman goal a couple nights ago, was that Tavares was being swarmed by a couple defenders because he was breaking them down off the cycle. And lo and behold, Zach Hyman gets a wide open goal at the back door. So I think if Tavares can keep playing like this, which he has been for the last couple weeks, this is the recipe for Toronto going far in the playoffs. It's having a Matthews line. It's having a Tavares line that is producing, that is living in the offensive zone and generating lots of chances. So this is super important for Toronto. John Tavares is their captain. They paid $11 million for him to get him in free agency. And to start the year, he wasn't looking like that player. If you look at his performance over the last month, though, this is definitely the John Tavares off the cycle, breaking down defenders one-on-one, the guy that we're used to watching over these last few years. So it's been a nice improvement to see in his game.
Ian Tolica is with us. So if you had your druthers when Nick Foligno makes his debut, maybe it's Tuesday, maybe the game after that, maybe next Thursday, I think in Winnipeg, who is he finding himself on a line with?
So we just talked about John Tavares and how good he was in tight spaces off the cycle in the offensive zone. I think Nick Foligno would work really well with a player like Tavares because some of the Leafs lines, they generate their offense off the rush. When you think of what a Mitch Marner does incredibly well, it's plays in open space on a 3-on-2. He'll find a way to slide his way to the middle of the ice and get a pass across the seam. And he works really well with guys who can create off those chances off the rush. John Tavares is more of a cycle-based, grind it out, win pucks below the goal line. And I think Nick Foligno will fit in with that because he can force his way to those tough areas of the ice. Justin Bourne at Sportsnet here wrote a great article about a month ago about how the Leafs in the Columbus series last year, even though the heat map showed that they were getting some scoring chances, they weren't from in tight. They weren't from the crease. And in the playoffs, when the refs swallow their whistles a little bit when it comes to those cross checks in front of the net, I think it's really going to help to have a Nick Foligno force his way into that space. And who's going to be the best player to take advantage of what Nick Foligno's doing offensively? Because we all know what he can do defensively. He's going to win pucks back. He's going to be strong in the forecheck. He's going to play against the other team's top players. It's what he's been doing for his whole career. But I think offensively, there's another level that Foligno can hit with his play off the cycle. And Toronto's best cycle player, in my opinion, is John Tavares. So I think those two are a natural fit. I'd imagine William Nylander is going to be on their wing. We'll see what they do. But part of what makes Nick Foligno such an interesting add to this Leafs team is that you can play him in a lot of different places. You can play him on that Tavares line. You can play him with Matthews Marner. You can play him on a checking line that faces some of the other team's top players. So he's a very versatile piece. But I think a lot of us are reading the tea leaves here, and we suspect that it's going to be Foligno, Tavares, Nylander. They're going to really see if they can make that work, because if you can, that's a line you can give 18 to 20 minutes a night and trust them.
I think, too, Ian, when we look at the acquisitions made at the trade deadline, I almost feel like one of the potential, it's not really a trade deadline deal, but one of the moves made that might turn out to be one of the better ones, certainly if you want to include it, and I'm using air quotes here, in the deadline, is that of Alex Galchenyuk. Like, are you convinced that Alex Galchenyuk is, and I'm using, again, air quotes here, a thing?
Yeah, or is he a guy? I know that's what they taught the guys on Good Show, you know, Mick Gaev, right, back in the day when they were trying to figure out, is this guy a player? Is he someone in a playoff series that you can play 10-plus minutes and feel good about it? I already brought up Justin Bourne, so I might as well bring him up again. He wrote an Alex Galchenyuk article today that really made me think. When I was writing my report cards last night about Galchenyuk, I was a bit frustrated that he blew his coverage as the high forward in the offensive zone. The way hockey works is we don't have positions anymore with respect to left wing, center, right wing. The only thing coaches care about is who's the first forward in on the forecheck, who's the second forward in on the forecheck, and who's the third forward. The third guy, F3, he needs to be covering for your pinching defenseman in the offensive zone. The way that teams are maintaining possession these days are by having a pinching defenseman go down the wall to maintain possession in the offensive zone, and the high forward, F3, comes up and covers for him. Alex Galchenyuk got caught a couple times the other night not covering for the pinching defenseman. And it's easy for us to see a goal go in, see a 2-on-1. We see the camera pan to the defenseman who pinched, and we go, well, it's the defenseman's fault. He shouldn't have pinched. That's not true, in my opinion. I think a lot of the times it's on the forward for not covering for that defenseman. When a team's system, a team structure is designed to constantly have pressure from that defenseman to keep the pucks in, you need to have responsible forwards like a Zach Hyman, like a Nick Foligno, making sure that they cover for those players. Now, you can say that any player, you can pull up video clips on a Mitch Marner doing this. You can pull up video on a Austin Matthews doing it. You can find Selke candidates, Ryan O'Reilly, Sean Couturier. Every player in the NHL has moments where they blow a coverage and a 2-on-1 goes against them the other way. The concern with Galchenyuk is that he's done this throughout his entire career. His first 10 or so games as a Leaf, we didn't see any of this. He was actually very responsible defensively on the forecheck as the third forward back. But we're seeing him kind of go back in some of those old bad habits. And if you're the coach and you're thinking, can I trust this guy against the other team's top six in a playoff series to not give up a 2-on-1 in a key moment of the game? With Alex Galchenyuk, even though his skill has been awesome to watch in transition, and you can pull off some higher level passes than some of the other players we've seen thrown into the top six, I think that defensive concern is real, and it's something that coaches are going to care about. So we'll see how he plays throughout the next month. If he can redeem himself a bit defensively and be more responsible as the high forward in the offensive zone, maybe you can convince yourself that Galchenyuk is someone that you can play in a top six. But based on his play last night, I think it's a legitimate concern that we should be bringing up. And Bourne did a great job in his article today.
Ian Tulloch is with us. So, you know, the goaltending situation is very, very interesting because, honestly, if you told me any one of Jack Campbell, David Riddick, or Frederik Andersen made a start for the Maple Leafs in the playoffs, I would believe you. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, but I also don't think maybe it's the worst thing in the world. How do you sort of land on where the goaltending situation is and what it might look like come whenever game one of the playoffs is?
Yeah, and when we look at recent history of Stanley Cup winners, a lot of them have played multiple goalies en route to winning a cup. It's usually you have your main guy, but sometimes the number two needs to come in for a start or two to help you get things going in the right direction. So if I'm the Leafs right now, I'd imagine that Jack Campbell is the guy that you want to be your number one going into the playoffs. I know he struggled in his last couple appearances, and I know that he's someone who is extremely hard on himself. James Myrtle's article about him kind of broke that down in detail, that he's his own harshest critic. And even though he's the nicest guy in the world and he's basically going around hugging everybody every day, everyone loves Jack Campbell. It's hard to not like the guy. But he's so hard on himself. He feels like he's disappointed his teammates when they lose a game. And that's a hard thing as a goalie. It reminds me of pitching in baseball. It's such a mental position where you need to be in the right frame of mind to get the most out of yourself. I worry that Jack Campbell down the stretch here, he's obviously not going to maintain that .940 save percentage he had for most of the year. It's on its way down. Regression to the mean is coming. How is he going to handle that? Is he someone who is going to be able to realize, okay, I've had a couple bad starts here, but it's time to get things going in the right direction? Or is he going to be feeling that guilt down the stretch here and it's going to affect his performance in a negative way? If that's the case, you have a Dave Riddick, you have a Frederik Andersen. I would imagine come playoff time, I think they would want Frederik Andersen to be number two on the goalie depth chart. And if Jack Campbell has an off night in the playoffs, you go with Frederik Andersen in the next game. But again, this injury situation, it's so weird. No one really knows what's going on. We haven't got a lot of information about it. The fact that they were willing to give up a third-round pick for Dave Riddick, I think speaks volumes to how much they trust the goaltending situation going into the playoffs. But if I'm just to guess, how are the Leafs going to rank it heading into the playoffs? I'd imagine Jack Campbell's number one, the guy that you want to give game one of the playoffs to. I'd imagine Frederik Andersen, if presumed healthy, would be the guy that they'd want to get in there as their number two. And Dave Riddick is number three. But a lot of that is based on what Frederik Andersen's injury actually is. And none of us are really sure about it. So it's a big gray area right now when we're doing our goalie analysis.
Great stuff as always, pal. Appreciate it. Should be very fascinating to see how Sheldon Keefe figures all of this out when Nylander comes back and Foligno makes his debut. Maybe we see a little bit of Ben Hutton at some point. A lot of chess pieces in the air for him. So should be very fascinating last couple of weeks. Good stuff as always. We'll talk to you again soon.
Hey, thanks a lot. I'm going to go take a rest, just like Joe Thornton probably should if he comes out of the lineup when Nick Foligno and William Nylander join the lineup. We'll see what happens there.